Busy news week, right?
I think a few things happened.
I don't know, like, what would we talk about this week if it wasn't for, you know, like iOS 14 code falling off the back of a truck and giving us so much insight into what's coming this fall with both the iOS update and the watchOS update, and even some interesting things about like Apple TV.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it'd be remiss to not acknowledge the developing coronavirus situation.
It's officially reached pandemic, which is scary.
It's a problem. It's a problem, yes. But you know, this is the tech show, so we're charging ahead.
This is if you want relief from that, you're self quarantining and you can't go anywhere, including to a March Apple event, which is an invitation only, or WWDC, which is very expensive. Then you just want to relax and get a preview of the rest of this year, you know, things that are likely to happen.
Things that are in development.
Makes perfect sense to me. You can find all of these stories that we'll discuss at 9to5mac.com/feature/exclusive, because they all are. And we'll also have them linked individually in the show notes. It's been fun. So let's just get to it. The first story that we covered, this came over the weekend, sort of the first discovery of what's coming, that based on iOS 14, which connects to watchOS 7 and a future Apple Watch Series 6, per se, Apple's developing features for blood oxygen detection. So this would measure blood oxygen saturation. And as far back as the first Apple Watch that iFixit tore down, they found evidence that Apple could do this if they wanted to, but they were probably limiting it for FDA approval reasons. They've since been accepted into a fast lane by the FDA to get things like ECG approved. So I'm not so sure if that's the reason or not.
Yeah, you think if they can get ECG out the door, the blood oxygen stuff would be less.
Yeah, it's a lot. Automatic. Yeah. But you know what's been so fun about these stories is especially the Apple Watch stories, I have to learn things to write them. It's like, okay, that I remember that from 2016, 2015, but 2014, what was that again? And it turns out, I'm sure medical people are familiar with this, that blood oxygen levels between 95% and 100% are considered healthy. So that's the goal. And with this feature, you'll be able to, if they deliver it, measure your blood oxygen saturation to see where does it fall between 95 and 100 if you're healthy. And I also learned that a blood oxygen level below 80%, so below 95% is bad, below 80% can be deadly. It can lead to compromised heart or brain functionality, so not good. Two very important organs. And the risk of respiratory or cardiac arrest is high when you have continued low blood oxygen saturation. So the Apple Watch, it won't just let you decide to measure it. It will notify you if you have below a certain threshold, probably 95, that you've got a low blood oxygen saturation level. And I guess the next thing from there, they'll have some advice on what to do. I would probably say you see a doctor or something soon. So, and it'll work similar to how the heart rate notification works. So the heart rate stuff is that you can measure your pulse and measure it in the background too, but you can receive an alert if your heart rate gets too high, that'll work out, or too low, which can be signs of trouble. This will be that, but for blood oxygen saturation. It's cool. There's a possibility that it could be a watchOS 7 feature, but it's probably an Apple Watch Series 6 feature. Just based on them not doing it before, that there's probably some hardware change that changes the experience.
A bit like the stand notifications and the accelerometer, right? Because they probably could have done stand notifications previous to the Apple Watch Series 4, like the full notifications, that's what I meant.
Fall detection, right?
Fall detection, yeah.
Opposite stand, yeah.
Because that relies on the accelerometer predominantly. But what they said was they needed to upgrade the accelerometer to be higher fidelity and give them more information so that they can, you know, wean out more of the false positives and actually get much more accurate on what is a fall
right.
and what isn't.
That's right.
You probably have the same here where, yeah, technically the little photo sensors in the back of the watch, that even back to the first one, they probably can detect blood oxygen to some degree of accuracy. But for Apple standards, you know, they want it to be good because essentially it'd be providing not real medical advice, but some proxy of medical advice at the end of the day. And they know that if they release a watch that is, you know, sufficiently inaccurate, they'll get blasted in the press two ways from Sunday. So if they're going to do it, they'll probably have the hardware, you know, optimized as well as the software experience. And, you know, like with all these leaks, this software implementation that we're seeing has probably been developed for a while and maybe even spans multiple years. And, you know, it's possible they don't decide to do it, right? Or the hardware's not ready, or they've just been testing internally and stuff. But it does seem pretty, like all the things that we're talking about seem pretty well developed to the point where, you know, they feel like they're close to coming out, not just like there's one reference to it in one tiny file.
Right. And the key here is that all these mentions are different from iOS 13, any version, including 13.4 beta. So it's that they're, which, I mean, the difference there also is publicly released software, even if it's a public or developer beta versus internal software that's like pre-beta, you know, in the alpha stage, basically. With the blood oxygen level stuff, you know, they've also got a pretty low, or a pretty easy standard to beat. So you can buy these like fingertip, sensors that are pulse oximeters. So what you do is you put your finger in it and it doesn't like hurt or anything. It's not very invasive. And then you turn it on, you can see your pulse rate and your oxygen saturation level and a pulse graph. And that's all it is. And it runs on a battery and they're like $20. So it isn't like Apple's inventing something new here. What the achievement would be is putting it on the wrist of people who wouldn't otherwise know to even buy one of these things. And then also with these, you actively put your finger in there and check. So maybe you've got a timed interval to check, or maybe just text sporadically. With the watch, it's checking for you always. It's sort of that, they call the Apple Watch and then like a silent health guardian or something like that. It's sort of that role where, you know, you're not going to walk around with one of these on your finger 24/7, but you would walk around with your Apple Watch, you know, for all the time. And it's pretty cool. So I hope this works out. And then I know that Fitbit, which Google is in the process of acquiring, if the deal is approved, they've got a version of this feature as well. I'm curious to see if what Apple does is more sophisticated, or more reliable, or how it differs from what Fitbit does. Because you can imagine a cheap Fitbit, which is on some of the cheaper models, versus, you know, a $400 Apple Watch. There could be a big difference in the quality there. So we'll see. The other thing from this report I wrote is that the ECG feature on the Apple Watch. So currently, you can take an ECG on your Series 4 or Series 5, but you can find inconclusive ECG readings if you have a high heart rate between 100 and 120 beats per minute. So basically, if you've just finished working out, or if you're, you know, doing something that stresses out your heart, then you won't be able to take an ECG, even if you're looking for, you've got symptoms and your heart's kind of, you know, fluttering. So, in this case, it we don't know where it's going to go, if it's going to be hardware or a software change that makes it happen. I think we've seen stuff where like software, they can do a better job in software and optimized it, you know, with time. And this would be 2 years on. So maybe it'll be Series 4 and Series 5 too, or maybe it'll just be Series 6. But you'll be able to take an ECG and have fewer of those inconclusive readouts, because it'll be able to handle higher heart rates, up to 120 beats per minute. Yep. There's continued evidence of sleep tracking, so that's not gone yet. And we've literally seen the sleep app, because Apple posted it on their own on the internet, through the App Store. So we look forward to that. And there's no evidence that that's gone yet. So bring on the sleep tracking.
And obviously the rumors from Bloomberg and stuff last year pointed to sleep tracking coming with the hardware revision coming this fall. So the Series 6. And WatchOS 7 combined.
That's right. And speaking of Bloomberg, our friend Mark Gurman at Bloomberg, he had reported that starting with iOS 14, there was officially a method for turning off features in development so that you can work on them internally through, you know, preparing for beta 1, but you don't have to release them in beta 1 and pull them out. You can just check a box, basically, and remove those features. They're still without losing your progress, basically. So
it's an easy way for engineering teams to turn individual components of what they're working on and off. So if you want to like test one thing, but you think something is interfering with it, you can turn everything else off and just isolate the individual components.
Yep. And those features are explicitly in iOS 14 versions, you know, developed a couple of months ago. So it's present.
And like feature flags are not like a, you know, Apple invention. They're very common in the software development industry. Loads of apps, like if you think about it, Facebook's A/B testing, for instance, that's just like a feature flag at the end of the day. It's like, uh-huh. Are you seeing this feature? Are you seeing this feature? And it's all just, you know, flags that you control remotely. And it's just, there's a lot of infrastructure that engineering has to worry about to make sure that when you're designing the individual features, you're doing it so that they can be individually turned on and off, and you're not putting, you know, links between all these subsystems so that you can actually turn things on and off properly.
Whereas, yeah, I mean, they
if you
may
turn it off and it's expecting the other things to still be active, mm-hmm. then it's not going to work. That's where you need like the policy management from within like the software organization to say, look, no, you have to code this stuff in this specific way, and they can only talk over these specific channels, so that if the phone's running in an environment where only these two features are turned on, or these two features turned on, or all of them turned on, it's still actually going to work.
Yeah, we saw some of them. I mean, this seems to be inspired by iOS 13's release and how it was not quite many features were removed before release in later betas. And they've always done this where they've got features in beta that don't make the cut, and so they get pulled before the final release. But it seems to be a big effort to do that. And the actual release version was certainly not the most stable version of iOS in the history. So hopefully this makes a difference in the future.
Yeah, like, say if they're working towards the WWDC seed, which is probably incorrectly named for this year, but the June seed, right, the first Dover beta seed, that is in previous years been, you know, a big bake together mess of everything they've been working on.
Yeah.
And what they can do this year, presumably, now that they're going to have something stuff more compartmentalized, is that before they get to June, like in the middle of May, they can do an assessment and say, look, these five features are not going to get the cut. So we can turn them off now, happily, because we've been planning to do it like this the whole year, and announce iOS 14 just with the features we're pretty confident we're going to ship, and then reintroduce the new stuff later down the road, but not having the embarrassment of having to announce it and then pull it out.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right, let's talk about headphones for a moment. So we've got, since 2018, like 2 years ago, Ming-Chi Kuo of TF International Securities told his investors that Apple is working on high-end over-ear headphones with AirPods features, basically. And this was like, you know, Apple owns Beats. They make Beats headphones. They've got a lot of on-ear and over-ear headphones that they provide. So what's going on with these AirPods? And then we got the Solo Pro headphones, which were not over ear, but they were on ear, and they cost more, and they had the same features as AirPods Pro, which came out on the same day but were announced afterwards. And so you've got noise cancellation, and you've got the audio pass through
transparency
feature, right? And so those were on those. So you know what's left to do. Well, those are Beats Solo Pro. There's also Beats Studio Wireless 3, which is, you know, arguably high-end over-ear headphones. They're certainly over-ear headphones, and they're pricey. So there's still room for Apple to do something either on their own or through Beats for that. And what the situation here is that in the iOS 14 code, we found not one but two icons that are sort of the glyphs within the system to represent the headphones and their label, which is clearly AirPods and then like a product number. And we see not one but two because it's two colors. There's a dark version and a light version, and it doesn't seem to be because it's made for like light mode and dark mode. Because if you switch light mode and dark mode on like the battery widget, for example, the panel of the widget changes, but not the icon.
Yeah, that'd be stupid if because like take AirPods, they're white, right? You wouldn't want the AirPods icon to switch to black.
Well, I mean, Apple's got a lot of black icons on its website for AirPods. So,
true, but that's kind of like when they're in the mix of other black icons because all their website icons are like glyphs, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So the pictures in the battery widget are meant to be mini representations of the product that you have. So if they just wouldn't make sense for it to turn to black. It would be like them inverting your photos when you change from light mode to dark mode, which they don't do. So
yeah, and we believe these will have features like Hey Siri and noise cancellation and transparency, and notably what you don't get from Beats Solo Pro or the even older Beats Studio Wireless 3 headphones are AirPods behavior for when you take them on and off. So with AirPods, you put them in, you take them out, and they've got presence sensors so that they detect your presence in your ear, they begin to play. If you remove them, they pause, and they hold that pause for a long, long time, and you can put them back in and resume where you picked off. With Solo Pro, if you take them off, they don't have presence sensors, so they keep playing, And what you do, they don't have a power button, so that's different. But they rely on you folding them and unfolding them to power them on and off. And in fact, and that's also, I guess you've got a button for play and pause, but if you want to do it like a gesture way besides a button, it would be to fold them and unfold them. So not quite as easy as AirPods. And presumably because these are, from what we can tell, Apple branded over-ear headphones, you know, that comes from Quo, and then the icon gives you a pretty good idea of what they'll look like, and that
yeah, people are like, this is just a generic headphones icon. I'm like, no, if you actually look at the mini glyphs for the Beats products, and like the Beats Solo even,
they're very specific. Different. Yeah, they're very specific, yeah. even between like Power Beats 3 and Power Beats Pro, they are very detailed. And if you zoom in, I mean, it's a very pixelated icon, but you can get a good idea of, oh, those ear cups are big, and oh,
yeah,
there's
the ear
a
cups
lot of,
look huge on yeah. these, on these Apple headphones.
And there's a lot like the even not the ear cups, but like around where the speakers are inside, like those are big too. And there's padding on the band, which probably makes them comfortable, which is a big hard problem to solve for on ear and over ear headphones. From color wise, like we can probably guess that there will be black or space gray and white. So those are your two options. And that would be the first time that something that's AirPods related comes in a color that is not white. So, you know, we'll see. And I don't know about the name. Like, I kind of feel like, you know, we don't know yet. And it's classified internally as an AirPods family, product. You know, I think we've assumed for a while that they'll be called something besides AirPods because AirPods just seem like earbuds. But I'm not so sure anymore. I kind of feel like AirPods has enough name recognition as a brand that, or a product family that these would be called like AirPods modifier, you know, pick your modifier. But they could fall into that category because they've got the same behaviors as AirPods.
Yeah. Cause AirPods and AirPods Pro are reasonably different in like they're still earbuds, but I think they can extend the AirPods brand, and the AirPods brand is very valuable. Right?
Yes.
It's a huge phenomenon. So I think they would carry on the AirPods brand if they can. Like you could, it's not hard for them to think of like AirPods Studio or something. Do you know what I mean? Like some kind of modifier yeah. like that would perfectly classify it as over-ear headphones, and people would be confused. Like down the road, if they became very popular, people probably just refer to them as studios, even though, you know, the Beats products would be in the far distant glint of an eye, but people would just refer to them as studios, right? Like I think they could definitely get away with calling them AirPods. Obviously the software leak doesn't show any either way. That just means they're based on the same like code base and
that's right.
the firmware on the AirPods on these over ear ones,
which is a distinction though, right? Which is a distinction from Beats products that have the H1 or W1 chip, but that those don't classify as AirPods internally, even though they're based like that. So
yeah, but like Beats and Apple are kind of like separate divisions.
yes.
So that doesn't surprise me. Like in the code, the Beats products are all, you know, all segmented away from, you know, the nice clean Apple stuff that the Beats team don't have any insight into whatsoever.
That's right.
And the other thing I would like to see from these that would separate them from the studios is like wireless charging. Of some
me too. I put that in the story as just like a you know, a wishful thing because
yeah.
with Beats they are slowly going from micro USB to Lightning on anything that's a new design from Apple. They still sell stuff with micro USB, but it was previously designed before Apple bought Beats several years ago. With the Solo Pros, they charge over Lightning, which is kind of acceptable for like a mid-range headphone, but USB-C sure would be nice. For these, if they have, I mean, I think they will have a port for charging, why not? But I would hope that they do USB instead of Lightning, because then you've got the same charger as your Pro iPad and your Air and Pro MacBooks. And, you know, it'd be nice to have that, the same as the iPhone charger on the other end, was that it's not Lightning, and we want that to go to Lightning eventually. But yeah, totally wireless, you know, make some kind of a thing. Like, in the story, I include a photo that you see in Apple stores where they have a display that is like an iPad in the center to tell you about the Solo Pro headphones on either side. But just like take that approach of like a headphone stand. That's the charger. To be AirPods, it needs to have wireless charging of some kind, because you've got wireless charging for all AirPods Pro, but I mean, even when AirPods didn't have wireless charging as a case option, putting the AirPods in their case was a charger, and it's just so different than plugging in a cable, even if you charge the cable with a case. So I feel like to be in the AirPods family, these need wireless charging of some kind. Or
they're probably not going to have like a portable case charger, but you can right. imagine some sort of stand or dock accessory.
Exactly, for your nightstand or in your office or somewhere, and that would be very nice.
Yeah, because I like the 12 South headphone stand thingy, and that solves the charger problem just by having the like a micro USB wire go up the center of the pole.
Yes.
But you could imagine if there were like little grooves that the headphones could just like sit in, and then the whole pole just like charges it.
You need like a smart connector for it, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Like a smart connector in the top of the bat on the headband.
Yes, yes, that would be very good. So these are something that are very much on my radar, and I'm glad to see them progress. It does suggest fall based on being in the iOS 14 code and not like 13.4 beta code. But you know, hey, we'll take it. And it wasn't just, it was like in 2018, Ming-Chi Kuo had these exist, and then they didn't happen that year or the next year. And we kind of thought Solo Pro, maybe that was what he was looking at. But then he did say this year that these would be expected to ship. So.
Yeah, because he had a report earlier in like January where he mentioned the over-ear headphones, the wireless charger, and then the
AirTags.
AirTags, yeah. And he said they were going to ship in the first half of the year. Now, that was before all of the production coronavirus disruption stuff, so it's not out of the question that a lot of that stuff has been pushed back now. But
that's right.
Even if we found it in iOS 14, they theoretically could still be like part of the internal iOS 13.5 builds.
That totally.
Right. So if they were, because they've done 0.5s before for hardware and stuff, and they did Apple Music on a 0.5, and you know they've done those intermediate releases if they really need to. So.
There's an iOS beta that doesn't work with a future product from Beats right now. So that's totally possible that they just
So potentially this is like stuff, the code that's in both future seeds of iOS 13 and iOS 14 as well, and they can obviously just strip it out from either when they need to. But at the moment, it seems like these are going to be full products.
Yep. Which is not terrible. I mean, we're in a weird place right now in terms of just how the world is working. But I will say, you know, just on a zoom out level, it's if you work on this code, then, you know, you do your job. There's a level at some point where the job is to secure the code, and we don't break into Apple and steal it. So that would be different. But once it finds its way into the wild, it's our jobs to report what we find, and it's nothing against people who work on the code. And it's like, you know, we're not breaking in to take it from anybody. But once it comes to us, then we can't ignore it, because it's literally what we're here for and how we function.
And someone else would do it, but worse. So
yeah, that's a very good point. All right, but and it is on that point. It is nice to have these things to look forward to in this year. And as long as you manage your expectations, that it's no guarantee, no promise, no announcement, but it's just evidence. Really good evidence. So.
Yeah, good evidence. It's not just like someone off the street told someone in a whisper. Like,
that's right.
This stuff exists. It's just we don't know the exact release time frame.
And also, I understand from readers who've asked, like, you know, what's the validity of this? Like, how certain are you? And it's just that it's like, it's in that context of there's, you know, anything can change. There's always production issues and development.
Yeah, it's not a fake build.
Yeah,
right?
But it's not
like,
fake.
You couldn't fake what it is. It's like a whole thing. Like,
that's right.
You couldn't fake the operating system from the ground up. Like, it's just impossible. You need to find the right software for your business, but you don't want to spend all day looking. You have other things to do, other things you'd probably rather be doing. Cut to the chase with Capterra. Quickly filter options to find the features and pricing you need, and compare top software choices side by side and save your favorites. Capterra is the free online resource that gives you access to everything you need to know before you buy. So spend less time trying to find software and more time doing what you do best. Find the right software for you at capterra.com/happyhour. Capterra simplifies the software search to just a few easy steps, and they help you make the most out of the tools that you find. Drill down into what is relevant to your industry with over 700 specific categories of software to explore. There's everything from project management to email marketing. Hear from people like you with over 1 million reviews of products from verified users. Don't trawl the web with endless Google searches. Capterra brings everything together into one simple-to-browse directory. It makes it easy to discover the right solution, and fast. Visit capterra.com/happyhour for free today. Find the tools to make the right software decision for your business. capterra.com/happyhour. That's Capterra, spelled capterra.com/happyhour. Capterra, software selection simplified.
Let's talk about Apple Watch Series 6 and watchOS 7. There are some new things in software that will probably be related to Series 6, some of which can just be in software. So the first thing is this new Infograph watch face, Infograph Pro watch face, which will be joining Infograph and Infograph Modular as the two, like you know, loaded with complications and the time watch face that goes, you know, fills the screen with information with no concern for design, I guess. I mean, there is some concern because you can customize how it looks, but it's like utility first and then the appearance second. So you're not trying to mimic an analog watch per se, or a digital watch per se. So Infograph Pro is the name of this new watch face. I would guess it would come to Series 4, 5, and 6, you know, because it would fit the screen. And they haven't limited like Infograph Modular to only Series 5, even though it came with watchOS 6. But what it is it's some sort of new watch face, and you know, we can assume it's analog based on it having this, I've listened to a ton of podcasts talk about this so far, tachymeter. Is that acceptable?
I would call it a tachymeter.
Okay. We'll go with tachymeter. So it's an element from analog watches, in the real world. I've got an image in my story of an Omega, watch face that has this around the dial. And it even says on the tachymeter, it says tachymeter because that's what analog watches would do. I don't think they'll put that on the Apple Watch. I think it'll just be the numbers, but it's a set of numbers around the dial that presumably, you can just imagine the watch face. You've got the circular dial and then you have this around that. And so maybe the circular dial is a little bit tighter. This is around that set of numbers. And then you've got the four complications in the corner and the inner complications as sub-dial complications. So not a big difference, but it's sort of like Chronograph meets Infograph Modular, like the Series 4 and later version of Chronograph, which is made for Series 3 and earlier and kind of looks funny on Series 5, 4 and later. But what a tachymeter is it's an analog watch scale that is used to measure speed and distance based on time travel. It's a very much analog thing, not just in that analog watches, but it's an analog tool, like a scale ruler would be, or a slide ruler would be.
Yeah, because obviously in a digital context, you can determine speed without needing a marked out, ruler, essentially.
You can ride your bike and see your speed. That's the thing. Over a distance and time. So it doesn't really need this, but I think it's just that, you know, someone said the Apple Watch design for the watch faces is that they've got a bunch of different digital faces that follow a certain formula, but they've also got inspiration from the analog watch world where they've got analog watch faces that are sort of start with an analog watch face and then go from there and see what you can, how you can enhance that on the Apple Watch. That's what the California face is like. And
that's what Chronograph is.
That's what Chronograph is, right. That's what so many of the faces are. And this is just another example of that. I don't think it's anything extraordinarily new. But it will be part of the software. So somebody had an interest in this that maybe they were thinking, like, wouldn't it be nice if the Apple Watch did what this analog watch could do and maybe much smarter because it's a smartwatch, you know? So,
yeah. I'm hoping there are slightly more design tweaks to it than just putting a tachymeter around the outside, because then otherwise it doesn't really justify its existence as well as the normal Infograph.
Or calling it Pro, because Pro suggests that you can do more with
it. Do more with the complication, maybe?
I mean, the worst fear is that it would be a new tier of Apple Watch where it's like Apple Watch and Apple Watch Pro, and it's only on the Apple Watch Pro. You know, that would be
Hermes exclusive.
Yeah, that'd be terrible, but I don't think that's the case. I think it's just Pro as a way to signal it's not the Infograph face from a few years ago. It's a new tier, a new version of that, and maybe you can make it even more complications loaded.
Yeah, I mean, that's like part of the problem here is that loads of people complain about the Infograph face of being too crowded, and this one sounds like he's just going to put even more on the screen at a single time.
Yeah. So we'll see what they do there. But let's all celebrate the word of the week, tachymeter. I think a lot of us learned about blood oxygen saturation and tachymeters this week for the first time. There's also this new ability, which I swear we talked about this on the podcast, or maybe I did on Watch Time, my other podcast. But
we definitely talked about this. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe it was even together on Watch Time.
Maybe.
But it was the ability – well, it depends on what you're thinking of, but it's the ability to share your watch face. So, you know, I mentioned it. Like, I kind of pride myself in not designing a custom watch face, but using the existing tools that you can do. Like, I did a post on this about Infograph when it first came out. You can make Infograph look anything like the old simple watch face or the new utility watch face, or straight up Infograph where it's just loaded with stuff. And the trick there is just to scale it back and add elements as you go. And, you know, I did a story on that and I like talked about how to do it and I had a graphic, but I couldn't share, like, you can share a shortcut for shortcuts, but you can't share a watch face on from the Apple Watch. So if somebody likes that design, they can look at it and then they've got to look at how to do it. The idea here is that at least from the watch app on the iPhone, you can message or airdrop your Apple Watch face configuration. So every Apple Watch has the same set of configurations except for Nike and Hermes, which won't be shareable. And any of those can be shared with other Apple Watch users. So I assume if you've got iOS 14 and watchOS 7, you receive it and there's some, you know, it goes to your watch app and it can be, it's in your watch face gallery and you can choose it as your watch face. There's a couple of things that are interesting here. So one is, when I talked about it before, it was also in the, sort of like app discovery, angle to it that I have thought on, because if you share an app or a configuration that has third-party apps, it would be kind of cool if you also download those apps and they're on your watch face and you set them up, you know.
It would probably like offer to install the apps at the same time.
Yeah, it would be nice. I mean, they've got a lot of infrastructure for automatically downloading apps from some trigger. It would be bad if it's just the watch face minus the apps that you don't have. That would be a little half-baked. But I like
that. That is what happens if you restore, if you like half restore your watch.
Right? Yeah. Or if you recover from, and you don't have a test light, if it was a test light flip beta, it's just left out.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Cause if you set up, when you set up your watch for the first time, like, or you restore from a backup, the apps take a long time to download. Right. But, and you can start using your watch before the apps finish downloading.
Yeah.
And if you go onto your preset phases, it will just be blank spaces where the complications are meant to be for the apps that aren't there yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would hope that when you're sharing the watch face, it does have some prompt to say, look, this watch face includes this complication from this app and this complication from this app. Do you also want to download these at the same time as installing the face? Yes or no?
Yeah. I'm going to take on a new hobby of Apple Watch face curating. And I don't think it's out of this world. And so I was definitely asking for this. I don't think it's out of this world for this to be a feature that they're laying, they use this, a feature that customers can use now, but it's also lays their groundwork for third-party watch faces, because those will need some sort of infrastructure for being installed and shared. And so this has a file format that you can use with AirDrop and messages, at least so far. We know that you can quick view these like as files on the Mac, for example, or in the files
which
app.
Then means someone can make a website, which is like a repository of Apple Watch face configuration.
Totally. Yeah. Which I would want to do. Like, you know, we talk about a watch face or something on watch time and people, you know, I ask people, what are you using? And, you know, hey, send it over and I'll include it. You know, it's more than a screenshot.
Which is exactly what people would do now for like shortcut stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, exactly. Yep. So I've wanted this, and it's so cool that it seems to be happening. Another feature that I've wanted, and we discussed at length in the fall and in winter on Happy Hour, is what do you do if you're a parent and you want to give your kid an Apple Watch, and they're not really iPhone age yet, but they're totally Apple Watch age? You know, benefits like tracking their location, them seeing the weather and the time and sunset, and being able to call if there's an emergency, or even call 911 if there's a real emergency. Those are all things that the Apple Watch can do that you don't really need a $5,000 to $1,000 phone for. And the other thing is with kids, the watch can go with them anywhere. You don't put it down and lose it. The phone can be lost easily, left behind. So I was big into Apple Watch for kids in the fall and winter. And I ended up, for my now 7-year-old, doing a cellular Apple Watch Series 3. And then I had to buy an iPhone for that to give. I had to give her the Apple Watch after I activated it with an iPhone that wasn't mine and had its own, you know, phone bill, and the watch had to have its phone bill, and I only gave her the watch, and we saved the phone for Christmas, but we really could have just not given her the phone. That was like what you had to do. With iOS 14 and watchOS 7, there are multiple Apple Watch kids features, so features for parents for having kids on the Apple Watch. It's a really big deal, especially to me. You know, I've had this experience already, and I've got another kid who will come of age, and this can be useful. So the first thing is that you can pair multiple, you've always been able to pair multiple watches, or for the long time, you've been able to pull multiple watches with one iPhone, but you only use one at a time. So it's your account and it's on the Apple Watch. It's based on which watch you either select manually, or which, if you do it automatically, which is activated, like on your wrist. And the other one can't be used. I mean, you can use it, but it won't be talking to your phone.
Yeah, it won't receive notifications. Yeah. It'll just be completely dormant.
And it has to be activated with your account. You can't use another account on that watch activated from your phone. So there's really no workaround here besides having an iPhone for each Apple Watch if you've got multiple users. The new model is that a parent or anyone can activate and manage an Apple Watch for a child without requiring a second iPhone. So there'll be new parental controls, and there will be the ability to take your iPhone and activate the kid's watch and manage the kid's watch from your iPhone without them needing an iPhone. And it's not just that. It's that there will be a new school time feature, which is very cool. This will be a feature that lets parents manage which apps and complications they can access during certain hours and days of the week. So the idea here is school time, you do this for class time.
So kind of like screen time, but for the watch.
Yeah, exactly. And I've kind of like, so for my daughter, I have her phone and we have her phone. She takes it to school in her backpack now, just so, you know, she's got it just in case. But I do not disturb Monday through Friday from the time she wakes up until the time she gets home from school, so that she won't get a phone call or notification and it go off, even if she's left the phone like unmuted or anything. And that reflects on the watch, but it would be even better to have certain behaviors managed by the school time feature. And as it stands now, her school, and I know a lot of schools, see the Apple Watch and they say, not put that away. So, you know, I think when you have school time built in, you can make the case that, hey, this is a managed Apple Watch in school time. So no watches unless there's school time on it.
It's for emergencies only. There's no, you know, you can't play random games or just mess around.
That's right. In
school hours.
That's right. You can't, you could maybe limit messaging, so you can't message and you can't like look up stuff, you know, on a test.
Do you remember that interview that Angela Renz had a couple of years ago where she was like, the Apple Watch is the best tool for cheating in class?
Yeah.
That was pretty tone deaf. But,
yeah. And now we have school time and she's gone. and then of course there's again more evidence there's sleep tracking in this, and it's neat, and there were a couple of things. So in the report I mentioned that Control Center will have, and maybe the iPhone will have, toggles for sleep mode and noise detection. The noise detection bit is a bit inaccurate. So sleep mode, there will be that. So I imagine sleep detection or sleep tracking, you know, if you've got it on, it will pick up you sleeping automatically. But if you want to turn that off and, you know, lay down or something, then you could do that. Flick up Control Center, tap it, and turn off sleep tracking. Turn it back on when you want to. The thing is it's not exactly noise detection. So it isn't like the noise app and turning that on and off, which would be okay for Control Center. But it's like sound detection. So there's some new accessibility features that relate to sound that we'll talk about later. This seems to be a toggle for that, not noise. So that's a change from the story. And then finally, there's a change to the architecture for Apple Watch apps with watchOS 7. So watchOS 6, you were able to develop standalone Apple Watch apps like David Smith's Geneva Moon, which has no app on the iPhone at all. You have to search for it on the App Store or discover it on the App Store to download it to the Apple Watch. There's no iPhone companion app at all. But it's still based on the extension architecture. And so with watchOS 7, we've got evidence that at least new apps made for watchOS 7 won't be based on extensions. So it just sounds like further independence from the iPhone, more capabilities for the Apple Watch. So it's a slow maturing process. But
yeah, this is a long time coming, because if you remember the first Apple Watch, they had the app situation where it was Bluetooth and everything was controlled on the phone and all the behavior was on the phone and it would just update the UI that was rendered on the watch. That was obviously an extension architecture. Then they promised that with watchOS 2, you get native watch apps. But when that was just an extension architecture, and everyone's like, oh, that's a bit silly. And it was still locked down to the very rigid WatchKit framework. That continued for 3 years, 4 years. Then they announced SwiftUI last year with the independent watch apps, and that did let you have more flexibility in the kind of interfaces and behaviors and actions you could make in a watch application. But fundamentally, the Swift UI stack was still running inside of this like app extension, which is, you know, probably a bit inefficient for the platform. Like when you're running an app on the iPhone, the app's just running by itself. It's not like being parlayed through this extension model. So you probably get like performance boost and memory efficiency. And the like, if they would making the model to be watch apps or maybe Swift UI from day one, they would have never been on the extension architecture. But they just got into that kind of like technical debt situation where the first Apple Watch, that was the model, it was an extension. And then they made it native, but the easiest way to make it native was just make the extensions run on the watch, even though that's kind of stupid because, you know, you're on the watch now, you're not having two separate devices talking over Bluetooth. And that just kind of carried over for several years. And now it seems like they've done the groundwork and the replumbing to, you know, have like truly native apps again.
Yeah, and I imagine it's totally backwards compatible. No reason to drop older apps. But
there'll be a slot alongside.
Yeah, just like how they do with iOS versions where by a certain date, if you're submitting a new app or eventually a new app update, you've got to use this new method. They even did that with some watch apps where you can't have the watchOS 1 app anymore. They were like removed from the store, and that's why Instagram removed their app, for example, and then didn't make a new one. So that's this. And I will say, like, in thinking about this, so we expect these betas to be available, you know, like around June, July. We don't know what will happen with WWDC yet. Regarding the coronavirus, it's like 110% certain that it will not be a public event. But it's just a question of how will they handle it otherwise. Presumably the information will be presented in another way, and that we will be able to install these betas, you know, not that long from now.
Yeah, they have to, because like the betas coming out is one of the steps along releasing the iPhone in September. Like,
yeah.
You can't really do much there unless they're going to like delay watchOS specifically.
Yeah.
Right. Like the iPhone is coming out in September. The flagship iPhone is coming out in September. Their business would be so crippled if they couldn't pull it off like September, October. Right.
That's yeah,
like
the fall. Frame. Yeah.
And so you have to, you know, work backwards from that, and their software development roadmaps and timelines are not going to be shorter than any normal year. In fact, given the situation, they might even be longer. So they can't not really do a standard beta period starting, you know, June or sooner, right?
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. So at the very least, you're going to have iOS betas in June, and they'll probably just do it more at the same time.
Yeah, like the latest iPhone release was the 10 in November of the year when the 8 and 8 Plus came out. And so you had
in September.
Yeah. And so you had those as like the upgrades to last year's phones plus this way better phone that came much later. But that was kind of an exception. Then there was the 10S came out, but the 10R was like 3 weeks later, right?
The 10R was the last week of October.
Yeah. So that was, again, similar production issues or strategy or something. And then the 11 and 11 Pro and Pro Max, they all came out on the same time. So at that point, they've caught up. They figured this out. And that's
Yeah, and this year, they are doing a lot of phones, like different
models. Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah, like at least four models this fall. That's separate to the iPhone SE 2, which we're expecting sooner. And so I'm sure that, you know, given the disruption that we're seeing, it seems unlikely that all four of them are going to come out on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
But they need at least, you know, two of them to come out at the same time. Otherwise, that would be what internally at Apple they're concentrating on. Number one priority is making sure the iPhone comes out in September, October timeframe.
Yeah,
they just have to do it because it has to be there for Christmas.
That's right.
So that just all, you know, that jigsaw puzzle all comes back to having the betas in development from November, right? Going through the internal betas, hopefully not leaking like it did, and then, you know, becoming a first public beta seed in June.
So. Yeah, and the other interesting thing here is when we do get the betas, for one, it'll be like a validation test of all of these stories that we're reporting out. It'll be like, that one, yeah, we got that one, got that one, you know. And it'll also be a much newer build, so we're looking at information basically like time freeze from December or so. And then the beta in June is like from mid-May or so, right? So it's a couple of weeks before the keynote is what you get put out that day.
I think it's like the start of May is when freeze the public beta release.
Yeah.
The first version.
Yeah. Either way, you've got a long time between December and May for changes.
Yeah. Because I was surprised when we were looking at this stuff how much stuff they'd actually got in there in December. Because generally, they don't start on the next major version until like November timeframe. Because that was famously what happened with iOS 7. is that iOS 6 had literally been in development for about 30 days, and then Forrester got kicked out. Then they decided they were going to do this whole revamp, and so they had a month less than normal to do this entire revamp of the entire UI appearance. And so that was like a big rush for, in that time frame. And that's generally the strategy they've stuck to so far. But we did start hearing some things like, do you remember a couple of years ago when I think it was Mark Gurman said that they'd started moving to a strategy where less things were necessary on 1 year cycles. They were letting projects, you know, develop and improve over like 2 year timeframes and stuff. So it's not all a big rush to do it in a single year. And I think the fact that this December build does have so much stuff in it is probably a sign that a lot of these things have been in gestation and working and been worked on, you know, last year as well. And
yeah,
this is the kind of stuff that they've, you know, now put in for the next round of big major releases. Can we finish this stuff in time?
Yeah, we've got stories on features that we haven't ran yet, but that are probably, they fit the bill as features that were described a couple of years ago. Like, for example, last year we got the home or the CarPlay, the new navigation page. And there were some changes, like you could use you could control third-party apps with Siri. And even with 13.4, you got the change where the dashboard view, you can have the map not be Apple Maps, but be a preview of Waze or Google or whoever adopts it. It seems like there are more features that we've got to report out that would fit that bill as a big CarPlay update, but that weren't, you know, they're tied to iOS features.
Yeah, like it's like painting by numbers stuff that we've seen talked about mm-hmm. from internal Apple sources. We're now, you know, finding the code references to match.
Yeah. So for, you know, a couple of things there, stay tuned. You know, we've got more coming. And also, you know, you can kind of need to look back at how these things have gone so far.
This week, Happy Hour is sponsored by OWC, Otherworld Computing. We're teaming up with OWC to give away Apple's new Mac Pro Rack. Yep, that's the $6,499 rack-mountable version of Apple's flagship Pro desktop. And beyond the Mac Pro, OWC will be providing the winner with 384GB of memory and an Excelsior 4M2 4TB SSD drive to upgrade the base Mac Pro into something even beefier. The 384GB of RAM normally retails for $1,900, and the SSD is priced at $999, which means the total giveaway that you can enter for free to win a machine worth more than $9,000. Now, this is all in celebration of OWC launching its range of accessories and hardware upgrades for the new Mac Pro. That OWC memory is super high spec, 2933MHz DDR4 ECC memory, and you can buy it from OWC today to equip your Mac Pro or Mac Pro Rack with up to 1.5 terabytes of RAM. And as usual with OWC, it's priced to save you money. The RAM pricing is about 65% cheaper than Apple's build-to-order options. Also, check out the Excelsior SSD, available now with up to 8 terabytes of storage. Designed specifically for the Mac Pro, it's OWC's fastest SSD yet, with over 6,000 megabytes per second real-world speeds. And it's completely silent cooling via a finned heatsink cover. You can put it in a PCI Express slot, or it can be used externally with an OWC enclosure sold separately. Thanks to OWC for sponsoring the show. Check out the show notes to enter the Mac Pro giveaway and learn more about OWC's new memory and SSD lineup.
So, okay, let's talk about sophisticated mouse cursor support coming to iOS 14 and a new smart iPad smart keyboard models with trackpad. This is a story that you wrote, and it was kind of funny timing because like last week we talked about on this podcast, I guess it was the information story about a trackpad, smart keyboard. And then you had a lot of ideas and a few emotions about how it would go. And so we kind of exhausted that topic. But what's new and how do you feel this week?
Yeah, so I ended up doing a story on something that I didn't like. But there we go.
And so I thought it was perfectly cool and fine. And
I mean, it's fine, right? It's not ideal. And if you want we're not going to reiterate what we said last week. We spent a lot of time on it last week. But if you go listen to that argument, still applies today, but we can see the kind of direction Apple's going in now. And it is very close to what you would get on a Mac. They are rolling out rich system-wide support for mouse cursors in the current 14 build. And so obviously in iOS 13, they had the initial like cursor support in accessibility, and it was clearly designed as a feature for people that have disabilities with movement and motor neuron disease and stuff like that, which need alternate ways to control the screen because they can't lift their hand and touch it and drag it around. And so they made this accessibility thing. That's why you have to have the little assistive touch icon on the screen. That's why the cursor's this circle that looks like a finger and like the size of a physical finger, not like a, you know, an arrow or what you'd expect on a Mac. And that's why you can only make it so small and you have to drag it around. And people in the intervening year have definitely adopted mouse support through that feature when they don't necessarily have accessibility. You know, they don't have an actual disability. They just want to use a mouse on the iPad. And the feature's kind of there, but it's also kind of not, because like you can assign commands to right click on accessibility today. But one of the examples is you can assign right click to long press. Not like right click to see a context menu. It's literally right click to long press. And when you right click with one of these, you know, accessibility mouse options, the mouse literally stops moving and it waits the amount of time a long press will take to make the long press gesture happen. Like, it's at that level of abstraction. Whereas what they're going for in iOS 14 is to make it, you know, pretty much what you find on your MacBook or iMac computers. Like, you're going to get like an actual support for actual right clicking, and apps will be able to respond to that in due course, probably opening context menus similar to what we saw introduced at iOS 13, you know, like when you long press and it pops up that little menu. That can probably automatically be triggered via right click without a developer having to do anything, because we see that happen with Catalyst as well. So when you right click on something that has a context menu interaction on iOS 13, when you run that app on Catalyst, it automatically turns that into a right click context menu. We've also seen stuff about how they're going to, you know, render the pointer on the screen, because that was a question we talked last week. Maybe they'll just have a cursor, maybe they'll have like some focus UI, like things pointing around and hovering up and bolding, kind of like the Apple TV. What we see in the current code situation is something much closer, just like a traditional, you know, Windows desktop experience. There will be a cursor that looks like an arrow. You can drag it around on a trackpad. When you hover over like a link, the arrow icon can change like a pointing hand, kind of what you see in Safari on the Mac, to give you that extra context. When you're in a text editing field, it can change to the little like carrot, the text editor, so you know that you're in the text editing context. One slight difference that we found is that there's a behavior where the mouse cursor, the pointer, will automatically disappear after a few seconds of inactivity. So if you don't touch the connected mouse or the trackpad, the little cursor will fade out after, you know, 4 seconds or whatever. And that's obviously a concession to the fact that it is actually, you know, a touch screen device, where they still want you to be touching the screen quite a lot of the time. And so you don't have to worry about dragging the mouse off into a corner or managing it. If you just stop touching the trackpad, it will just go out by itself and you can just carry on using the touch screen. And then you want to use the mouse again, you just flick it and it reappears.
Yeah. You know, I'll let you feel however you feel. As someone who, I've got the 16-inch MacBook Pro, and I've got the 12.9-inch iPad Pro from 2018, the newest one, and I've got the smart keyboard and the smart cover. So, two different cases, and sometimes I just use it without either of those. I just use it like as a full-on iPad, in tablet mode. But I wasn't using it with the keyboard for a while because it felt like, well, I've got the MacBook and it can go anywhere with me, and I can do most stuff on the MacBook better than I can on the iPad, just for what I do. And a few days ago, I dropped the iPad off of a hotel bed to the hotel floor, and the smart cover folio fell. You know, it took a beating as it fell, and it's got nicks in it where you can like see like underneath the gray cover. So like, this is kind of janky now. So let me put the smart keyboard back on it. And it changes the way the iPad works for me in a way that it's not so similar to the MacBook, that I've got a larger screen MacBook. But it's still better than just using the iPad without it for me. And then I've got the pencil attached to it too. And I'm using both, at different times for different reasons. And the big thing that I feel like I'm still missing when I look at the iPad versus the MacBook is multiple windows that are not just like split screen. Yeah. And I was one thing I noticed a few nights ago was that the iPad 12.9 inches felt tiny compared to the MacBook 16 inch. Because there's, you know, a 3-inch difference there. And then also I was in messages and I wasn't like in split screen or anything, but I was just thinking like, this is as bad as if I was in full screen on the Mac with messages. Like, there's so much that I don't need to look at and focus on. There's this big list of messages and, you know, a lot of blank space.
Yeah, massive margin where the bubbles are, like, mm-hmm. left and the right.
Yeah, and it's like, this would be the perfect window to shrink down and just have floating around macOS style. And I've got a lot of those kind of apps that where I can do a lot of small things on the Mac at one time. And cursor support gets you pretty close to that, but it still doesn't give you the fundamental thing of windowing versus split screen and slide over and all those tricks. So,
yeah, and they try to kind of compensate for some of that with the fact that you can have multiple apps in a slide over at one time and you like slide between them. That's kind of their like current substitute for how do you actually juggle so many apps at a single time. But it's not ideal because often you want to be juggling apps that are landscape and not just portrait, right? And so the slide over experience is this basically like tall iPhone. And then you have, not only do you have the mental cognitive load of like a second stack of apps that you have to manage separate to your main multitasking array, it's also, they all have to be this set size.
Yeah.
And there's definitely more they can do where you could do, because like picture in picture video is a good example where, and that, you know, that started on iOS and got migrated to the Mac. But that is like a multi-window experience that is way simpler than what the Mac could offer. And I think there's more they could do there where if you could have like picture-in-picture apps almost that are slightly bigger. And so, yeah, they are kind of like floating windows, but you can still, you know, flick them off to the side, drag them around, they snap to the corners, that kind of, you know, that kind of thing. Like there's more, there's definitely more they can do there where they can enable the productivity, because the like what they did with slide over, I can see where they're going with it, but it's just not enough. Like, you know, you're juggling a deck of cards where one by one, whereas on the Mac, you can lay all the cards out at the same time.
That's right. For me, and I can see a couple of like design elements where it's like the window in focus, it's sort of like they do with group FaceTime where the person talking is larger and then there's like smaller cards that change size based on like when you've talked to them or, you know, when they've spoken. And so you've got like, you know, the main window that you're using right now, but behind there you've got super fast access through multitasking to click on or tap on another window or click on another window in this case, because you could be able to click and it becomes your big window. And then the one that you were using like shrinks down, or an option to just like say kind of pen a few windows. So if it's sort of a processing limitation, you know, you could model it similarly to the current design of having, you know, up to 3.5 apps on the screen at one time. Those could be like the ones that were larger, like on group FaceTime. And then you've got, you know, representations and like picture in picture view where it's not just the icon. You can also see what's happening, in the background. But for me, like what I would need to, the iPad's so powerful and the form factor is so different than the MacBook, and that it can be a tablet. It can be, I mean, it's closer to a convertible from Apple. You know, and it's got a great screen on it. I would take a bigger one than 13 inches. I would take like a 15-inch or 16-inch iPad, you know, keep it in a keyboard case with a pencil attached to it. You know, I have LTE. I pay for that every month, and it's so great. It's like my I use the MacBook on the iPad hotspot so much. If the iPad could just do what I do on the Mac, I wouldn't do that. You know, and it's crazy. So I would love that. But I just want to have like TweetDeck, like one or two columns of TweetDeck visible. So I see my timeline and like whatever else I'm tracking at the moment. And then all of the other windows that I'm working in and switching between Slack and Safari and Mail and RSS and just any small utility that I'm using, be able to get to those with a click, you know, or with a tap. And just have them be layered. And also, you know, the concept of a desktop on the iPad wouldn't be terrible. You know, have a place that's not the Files app for files that you're kind of working on right now. There have been apps that make like shelves and things like that, as like targets for putting things. But, you know, the desktop is a proven metaphor that works. And, you know,
I mean, like
years ago it wouldn't, but now that you've got a Files app, why not?
Yeah, exactly. Like
you have a folder called desktop.
The iPad, they fiercely tried not to do the file system thing, and then they just kind of gave up and did the Files app. And before that, it was called iCloud Drive. So that's fine. And if you're going to go that model, for sure, you should make it way easier to manage those files. And there's no reason it has to be self-contained into that single application. You don't have to recreate the entire like Finder hierarchy on the home screen, you could take the home screen today and let you just pin some documents and some folders to it, and mm-hmm. they would open similar to app folders, but instead of seeing apps, you'd see documents, right?
That's right. Or put them on the dock, and you know, the way you've got folders on the dock next to the trash can next to your apps.
Yeah, almost like, you know, like the downloads folder on the Mac, and then you could click on it, it springs open, and then you can quickly select a file or drag and drop it into another app. Like, there's loads of stuff I can do there. We haven't found evidence for any of that.
No. But between December and May.
But for sure, if you're going to add like traditional Mac accessory support, like mice, then yeah, people are going to want multi-windowing even more because it feels more and more like a Mac, just a limited Mac, right?
Yeah.
And so hopefully there is some, you know, concessions to that coming down the line, and we'll see. What's interesting about the cursor stuff is that some of the gestures that are kind of implemented are things like tap two fingers to right click. And so that answers, you know, what form factor are we seeing here? And there's two, as of yet unreleased, smart keyboard accessories referenced in this build, probably for different sizes of iPad. And the fact that it comes with things like tap to click, tap two fingers to right click, although the code doesn't necessarily say, like, it looks like a normal trackpad, you wouldn't have those kind of things in there if it was some weird thing like, you know, what we were speculating last week, where it could be like a two-finger, you know, swipe over the keys and stuff like that. No, if you're going to have put two fingers down to right-click and then tap to click, you're imagining a trackpad with some kind of depression, right? And that's probably not like a fully physical click. It would be like haptic. Mm. Like, it'd be like the Force Touch trackpads that you have in the laptops. So it is kind of hard to imagine right now how they would take the smart keyboard and put a trackpad below the keyboard, because then you're getting a pretty big accessory, but maybe it doesn't look like the smart keyboards today. Maybe it's more like clamshell style.
Yep. I don't know. You can do a two-finger gesture on the, like, the trackpad or on the keyboard on the iPad, the virtual keyboard, but that it would be even more difficult, I think, on the physical keyboard. You're right. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so it's going to look like a lot like a MacBook, right? It will look... You have a very similar mouse on the screen. It'll look the same. You'll have a trackpad below where the keyboard is when you type. And so you're getting ever closer to the kind of like iPad laptop, at least look, if not, you know, fully enabled in the software features.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome. All right, let's talk about some augmented reality stuff in iOS 14. So this is AR. What's new with AR in 14 that we believe will be coming, or at least is in development?
Yeah, so... Apple seems to be developing a new application. So this would be an independent stock app. We don't know the final name, obviously, but it's codenamed Gobi, like the Gobi Desert. Mm-hmm. And it will allow people to get more information about the world around them based on tags, maybe based on QR codes. So you'd scan a QR code and then this like augmented reality experience would spring into life because it would be able to cross-reference it. There's possibilities that it would support like detection via iBeacon, or maybe the Apple AirTags have a mode where they can tell other devices where they are, because that's more elegant than scanning a QR code, but mm-hmm. the QR code's like the base level. And that would also then tie into the forthcoming AR headset stuff that Apple's working on. So as well as being an app on the iPhone, it would work on the AR headset thing that we believe is still coming within, you know, not too long away. And because what we've seen so far with how the headset code is developed, it's kind of like an AR extension for apps that you have installed on the phone. So similar to the original Apple Watch days, is that you'd be able to run apps on the headset that are basically being rendered from the phone. And there's little like flags that suggest that this app here, this Gobi app, would be one of those ones where it works by its independently on the phone, but if you do have the headset, it can then do the same experience directly on your eyeballs. And this is the kind of thing that Apple could use in the Apple Store. And in fact, in the code, it seems to suggest they're actually doing test demos with Apple Store merchandise. And you could hold up your phone over the laptop and then all this information would show around it. Similarly, seems to be testing with like Starbucks coffee going on. I think it's weird that this at least is being developed as a standard application, because it's the kind of thing you'd expect to be part of like the camera app already, because... Mm-hmm. The camera app does do QR code scanning.
Clips like, 3.0.
You just hold up the camera app to a QR code and it will scan it and it will show a notification and say, do you want to go to this website link? And you click it and it opens Safari. And so you can imagine in my head, well, they could do the same thing for an AR thing. You hold up it to a QR code tag that's referencing an AR experience, and the camera says, here's an AR experience, click to see it. And maybe that integration is coming, but it is, for now, seems to be a separate dedicated application.
Yeah.
And you can imagine stuff like, you know, aiding the shopping experience with showing information about the product that you're hovering, but even just more like trivial than that, look at what Apple's already doing in the Apple Store with their like art project, which is AR brackets with a T on it, where you have this like in-store visual menagerie of stuff that they've got artists to design, and then you can walk around the store and see what's going on. To do that today, you have to go into like the Apple Store app, click on some buttons. Maybe you have to if you go on one of the little AR photo walk things, they rent you. Well, you know, they give you the iPads to borrow while you're on the trip.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine this kind of application being built in allows them to do that much more elegantly using people's own phones. And then also there would be a third-party API for integration here. So other apps would be able to say, hey, we provide real-world AR experiences too. So if you see our little flags flying around, maybe you just see the company logo, then our app can launch and do its cool thing at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that API could be open to anyone. So any app that you have downloaded on your phone could contribute. Or it could be kind of like the CarPlay system where it's based on entitlements and Apple only allows select partners to join in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know if any Google Glass consumer apps are still supported, or if it's like that was so long ago that they're long dead?
Well, Google Glass wasn't really – it wasn't super on augmented reality because, yes, it would put stuff over your face, but it wouldn't really like – locate something in the world and like augment it. It would be like just a separate menuing system that would show over your eyes.
Yeah, it's like your eye. It was like your smartphone screen on your face.
Like if you had like an Apple Watch UI in your eye line. Mm-hmm. Like it's not interacting with the world. It's just kind of overlaid, mm-hmm. which is still useful. And you can imagine seeing like text messages and stuff come in, and you just mm-hmm. like glance at them. But it's not like the AR experience that we've seen Apple do today, where there's like interaction with physical objects. And that's kind of what this Gobi thing sounds like.
Yeah.
In terms of just, is Google Glass a thing? It is used in some very select enterprise applications.
Medical is one I see sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, and especially, and that's, medical is quite common with the Microsoft HoloLens as well. And the HoloLens is closer to the full like AR experience, and it can track the real world movement and the camera and interlace objects like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, the more we discuss this stuff, especially with the headset, I'm more and more curious about ways that, like, I had no interest in this before, when it was first rumored. It's like, it sounds like an experiment, not a product. But I was just thinking, like, you know, go for a run, and I wear glasses, so I imagine there's some version of this that works with glasses, and, you know, see the data from the Apple Watch on the glasses. That would be neat, without looking at the watch at all. Or like see a text message and be able to read it from the glasses without looking at the watch and like having it, you know, with the wrist raised while running.
Yeah, see your working information, see your current pace. Mm-hmm. It could do a little like flag if you're not going fast enough. Yeah. It could show you little activity badges flying by. Text messages could pop in. You could glance at them. Like, I do think there's potential for AR headsets. The big question mark for me is like, is the AR headset that we all imagine as being good possible to make in the current time frame?
That's right. Right? That's
and
right.
And there's also it's really impaired by battery life problems. Is there just enough processing power to do what people imagine when they're like, this AR is great, and then you get to the real world and it looks like terrible, like three polygons on the screen.
Very preliminary. Track right?
Your eyes fast enough, and the battery runs out. So yeah. There and like cellular data and all that stuff. So that is the big question mark for like the Apple AR headset project. Yeah. It's less about what, in my opinion, the stuff I'm excited about with the AR headset stuff is more what we just described, and less about like you can hold up your phone to a MacBook in the Apple Store and it'll show you a bit more information about it.
Indeed, yeah. Yeah. It's hold up to the new pair of glasses and use the information about those. I spent some time with my wife's grandparents last weekend, and they were mentioning to me that they went to sort of an accessibility for low vision conference, maybe for all types of accessibility, but they were focused on low vision technology. And it's because my grandmother-in-law has recently been losing her vision at a very fast pace, and so she's you know, she's got a lot of life in her, and she wants to do things with like reading, and she's found things like audiobooks for the first time, and she's very big into using all the vision accessibility features on iOS. But they were telling me and like showing me pamphlets for things that they saw there, like a pair of glasses with a camera on it that can recognize the gender of people, which might be problematic, but also like if you've got their face saved in your, you know, I guess app that it talks to, then it could tell you, it could identify who you're speaking to. So if I'm looking at you, Benjamin, it would say you're speaking with Benjamin in your earpiece. And that's kind of neat. Like, you can imagine Apple doing that with what they already have. But also if you look at text, like if you look at a book, it could line read for you. You know, just like you could do character recognition from an iPhone, or OCR, optical character recognition, you know, with any kind of PDF apps. This is that, but in a headset, it's like all those tiny things that you can do on an iPhone and have been able to do for so long. They've already got all of that built as an iPhone feature. And if they brought that to a product like this, you know, you've got to find, I think for this to be successful, you need to find consumer angles for this thing. But then, The device that recognizes faces and reads books for you, basically, it's $6,000. And Apple's thing won't be $6,000. So I'm kind of getting more excited for what this thing can be. And even thinking of ways that I could use it, like I mentioned on a run. And that made me curious if Google Glass was still hanging around, like in what form, if anything still worked for it, but to get like a preliminary example of what this would be like. So maybe I'll seek out a pair of Google Glasses. I don't know. But
and it probably pairs with an app that was last updated in 2015, and then never.
Yeah, probably Letterboxd, and yeah, exactly. That's true. All right, let's talk about some iOS 14 stuff as it relates to the iPhone 9 or SE 2 or whatever you want to nickname it. This also includes information about iPad Pro. My favorite is there's some Apple TV news here that is what we've known, which is a new box is in development, but that also there will be an Apple TV remote redesign, and you've got good advice on managing your expectations for that. Plus, there's AirTags information and more. So what's iPad Pro and iPhone 9?
On the iPad Pro, what we see in iOS 14 code is that the camera system will have the wide-angle lens like it does today, it will get the telephoto lens for zoom, it'll get the ultra-wide lens like the iPhone 11 series. So it's triple camera, and then it will also have the time-of-flight 3D sensor that everyone keeps talking about, which will have augmented reality applications, quote-unquote, maybe, which maybe ties into the Gobi app as well, thinking about it, and also might enable stuff like portrait mode and some cool effects, and that sensor is what we're expecting to come to the iPhone in the fall. All the kind of like CAD drawings and stuff we'd seen of the iPad Pro so far, they only had like three lenses on them. It didn't have like a full spot for what we assume is required to have the time of flight 3D sensor as well. So that's kind of something new that we've turned up in the code. But it's definitely true that devices this year will have three cameras and the 3D sensor, because that's what the high-end iPhones are going to have. It's just news that we think the iPad Pros are now going to have that as well.
Yeah, what's confusing with iPad is when each model comes out, you know, because yes. I think it sounded like there'd be a Pro in the first and the early part of this year, and then maybe a different Pro in the late part of this year, or at least the trackpad stuff in the late part of this year. So a lot of cloudiness there. I could see them just doing new stuff in the fall for iPad, and not doing something in the spring, but we'll see though.
Yeah, because there keeps being conflicting reports on there is this feature and this feature for the iPad Pro, but then there's also an iPad Pro in the fall that also has this feature and this feature, like mini LED was the most recent chatter on that angle. So it's not clear yet if there really is a March iPad Pro update, or, you know, March, April, spring update, or if people are just kind of getting their wires crossed a little bit. And especially given the current climate, the iPhone is very important. Everything else definitely can be deferred.
That's so, right. Except for the Apple Watch, you know, can't defer that.
And the new Apple TV remote. That's keeping the society together.
It must have, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, so speaking of the iPhone 9, which we don't know, it's going to be iPhone 9, iPhone SE 2. Unsurprisingly, the code mirrors our expectations. It's going to look a lot like an iPhone 8, which means it will look like a lot like the iPhone 6. but it will be based on Touch ID with a home button. And it will, which one thing that is new is that it would have support for Express Transit, which is a thing where you can authenticate Apple Pay at terminals in like the subway or in the London Underground without having to type in, without having to authenticate your, with your face biometrics or your fingerprint biometrics. Mm-hmm. So it's just a quicker way for you to move around.
Yeah, dead and phone still works.
Because that wasn't there before on mm-hmm. that form factor.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to our friends at Smile Software for sponsoring Happy Hour. Save time typing and boost your productivity with Text Expander. It helps you manage everything that you type repetitively. Email addresses, phone numbers, messaging replies, and so much more. Turn the things you type into reusable snippets to access them time and time again. And your snippets can be as simple as like a phone number or more complicated like a long form with fill-in fields and automatically calculated dates. Text Expander works everywhere you type. Word processors, email apps, messaging, spreadsheets, web apps, everything. No special plugins, it just works. And Text Expander goes beyond simple find and replace. Customize your reusable snippets with fill-in fields and pop-up lists. You can quickly stamp out an invoice with easily editable fields to change only the bits that need to be customized for each individual. If you've ever written something twice, there's a good chance you could work smarter and use a Text Expander snippet instead. It's not just about automating repetitive work, but reusing snippets ensures consistency in your messaging and removes human error. Text Expander is available for macOS, iPhone, iPad, Windows, and Chrome. So pretty much everywhere. And Smile is running webinars every month to help you get up to speed and make the most out of Text Expander. There's online tutorials aimed at beginner, advanced, and team levels. Again, unlock your productivity with Text Expander. Listeners to this show can get 20% off their first year subscription. Visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more and sign up. That's textexpander.com/podcast. And then the Apple TV situation.
A new box. What we expect. But
there is
new Siri remote of some kind.
A new remote of some description that will have a microphone. But there are a lot of people in the world that want a radically different Siri remote. I don't think the Siri remote is that bad. We've spoke about this on the show before. It just needs like a few little tweaks, like make it a bit bigger so it's easier to, there's more trackpad for you to actually use. But either way, you do have to qualify the new remote in code, because the last time there was a new remote with a new model identifier, that was the generation where they added a gyroscope for better motion controls, which no one uses, and they made the menu button have a white ring around it, and that was it, compared to the fourth gen remote, which didn't have the white ring. And definitely when the white ring was added, everyone was complaining about the Siri remote needing a redesign then. So it wasn't like Apple was caught off guard or those complaints weren't happening. It was like a joke at the time that all they did was added a white ring. But now we're like 2 years on from that. So it's a good reminder that when they're doing a new remote, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to change the whole thing up.
What I would like to see, so if you're a fan of the remote now and you don't want a radical change, which I know is like a minority of people, or at least a minority of vocal people, is if they kept everything like almost the same and they did like a white ring around it approach, is the ability for you to ping the remote if it's lost in the classification, just put some kind of connectivity where you can, with your iPhone app to the Apple TV, like ping it from the iPhone, but especially with Siri.
The Apple TV can do Find My through Siri directly.
Well, if you lose the remote, then you can't use it for that purpose. You need to use the iPhone.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
The future Apple TV will totally have onboard Hello Siri support, so you don't need to use the remote for it.
Like the Fire TV from ages ago, right? Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be wonderful. that would be very cool. And that's all you got to do. And then you got a new Siri remote, and you can find it. And you can even do the thing like with Siri on the HomePod or your iPhone, where you say, "Where is the remote?" and it pings it. That's like an underrated new feature from the fall that is so useful. I mean, it's even better than finding your phone from the watch, because you just yell it into the air and it makes it ring, and it works with family. So if you do family sharing, it's all the devices in your family that can say, "Where is Rory's iPod?" when he says dad pod, and it'll locate it for me. So it's really useful.
And you can differentiate between iPad and Mac. You just say it for the person, and if you happen to have two phones, it will say, "Which one do you mean?" You can say the right name.
Dayphone.
It's really good.
Mm-hmm. All right, Apple TV Workouts app, codename Seymour. This is something that really interests me, because I think on Watch Time podcast, I mentioned this as something I wanted. But in using Peloton for like at home, treadmill stuff I love, and I reviewed the treadmill and had to send it back. It's so expensive. I wish I could afford it. And then the bike, which I do have, I really enjoy that as well. You've got, on demand and live classes. And I've long been writing about and talking about a request where Apple like buy Peloton, or you don't really need Peloton for it. You can just make your own thing where you've already hired a bunch of ex fitness coaches and experts, and hire even more and have them make videos. Because the thing that's missing from the watch for me is that you've got the Apple Watch workout app with all the different, workout types, but you've got to kind of figure them out on your own. And even if it's like this, just a set of videos to get you started would be very useful. Because for me, what that is the original Apple Watch video that talked about the health and fitness features, which has since been removed from Apple's YouTube channel. And like, I have it unlisted on my channel just to be able to see it. But it's gone from Apple officially. That is like, this is what you can do with the watch, all of these different workouts and activities. This seems to be like something like that where it integrates with Apple Music, it syncs with the Apple Watch, and you use your Apple TV for these guided workouts that you download. And as someone who has gone all in on the Fire TV because of different things the Apple TV can't do, this would bring me back in. And maybe it would work on the iPad and the Mac. And
yeah, surely they make an iOS client.
Surely, yeah.
An Apple TV experience. Yeah,
but just to have it on the Apple TV, I mean, if they put it in all the different app stores for other boxes like they do for the TV, yeah, that would be even better. Maybe it's a TV feature, I don't know. But it sounds like it's a separate application and coming with, I would say, TVOS 14 at least. So it sounds really cool to me.
Yeah, I hope they even did like audio workouts so you could just have like your AirPods and your watch on. And
yeah, they pushed Nike Run Club for that, and they need to just roll their own.
Themselves.
Yeah, because they've made a better workout app for run tracking than Nike Workout or Nike Run Club. And they partners, and Tim Cook's like, you know, part of the board of Nike and everything. Well, like, just make a deal with Nike and have them, their trainers, like some of the Peloton trainers are ex-Nike trainers. So there's a lot of talent out there. Just buy them and, you know, make these features happen. Because I think it's so useful because, you know, people, because the Apple Watch can do so much, if you buy it for fitness features and then don't take advantage of it, you can probably find something else that's useful, like messages or Apple Pay or something. But it's a shame if that happens because it can be so effective at the fitness stuff. And so anything from Apple directly to say, this is what you do with it. I mean, the iPad's had the similar problem in the past where it's like, I've got the iPad, but I've also got a Mac on iPhone. What do I do with it? And they've been pretty good at marketing different ways that you can use the iPad. I think they need that for the watch too. And this sort of product would be that.
Yeah, and you know what this reminded me of when we found it? It reminded me of the guitar sessions lessons they had in GarageBand.
Yeah, I hope it's not that bad.
They had the videos and you could like, and it was that piano as well, and you'd follow along, and you know, that didn't replace music coaching or teaching, but it was cool little bit that you could do there if you wanted to, and it probably sold computers. Could be like, I'm going to learn an instrument, I'm going to buy a Mac. And then whether they did or not is kind of immaterial.
I mean, I used to love GarageBand as a thing because there was not really a direct comparison on Windows. And then when I had a Mac initially for college, I think I bought one of those classes that was like John Fogerty from Creedence Clearwater Revival did one. And it was cool. Like I didn't do it beyond that. Maybe these days I would, but they don't seem to be really promoting those anymore. But
yeah, I'm not sure if they even have them in like, they don't have them in the iOS version for sure.
Right, which is really too bad.
Out of the Mac one.
Yeah. But yeah.
But that's kind of interesting because like that was obviously like a small scale effort. Mm-hmm. And that could be what they're doing here, or it could be like a whole thing with like a storefront and then like a services narrative behind it.
I think to do this the right way, like the small scale would be you've got introduction videos where it's like just guides to doing things, which, you know, is something that doesn't exist yet, and that would be a good product to have. But I think for it to succeed and for it to, you know, not be like those introduction videos for the Apple Watch materials that got removed eventually from the Watch app, but to be something that is useful at all levels of Apple Watch experience.
Day in, day out.
Yeah, it would be a service that you subscribe to, just like you would for news or music or, well, not about Disney's, but music or TV, you know. Like, I would pay. I mean, that's what Peloton is. You pay Peloton, even if you have their bike or treadmill, you also pay for a membership And then you can also pay for a membership without the hardware, but use it with your iPhone and like your gym. And it's that's their business, you know? So there's no reason if Apple won't buy Peloton for them to just do it on their own. And
it's another thing for them to throw in a future bundle that they eventually make of.
Right. And it's especially like, you know, it's Apple Music integration here. So, yep. And you want the Apple Watch to use this feature. So, if you buy this, you know, like they probably don't cross bundles. Like if you do a family plan, it's just not going to be bundled. But if you're an individual and you have this, Apple Music might be required. And then, and also Peloton has an issue with music licensing. There have been litigation involved that has resulted in the loss of music. And, you know, it's been kind of rough in that regard where they used to have a better music collection and now it can be. It's not limited, but it's just not as vast as it once was. Well, with Apple Music, and they've got this new deal with labels now that didn't result in a bundle being in the situation, but at least there's some new terms, I guess. But you would have the full library of what you've got in Apple Music, so there'd be like playlist, not just a workout playlist, but like a workout playlist with a workout. You know, it could be such a cool product and a reason to have a watch, reason to have Apple Music, and pay for this service for the videos.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep, cool. Let's talk about the next thing, which is about iOS 14, if you haven't guessed yet. And
is it about iOS 14?
It's about iOS 14. And it's kind of huge. I mean, in my opinion, it's kind of huge. It also kind of reminds me of like an Android switcher feature from familiarity. It's that iOS 14 will include a new home screen list view option with Siri suggestions and more. So one of our friends, Parker, from over at BuzzFeed, has made some pretty cool looking mock-ups of how this could look. So I'll have that link in the show notes so you can check it out. But this could be any number of things. It could be an alphabetical list where it's fixed and just like the Apple Watch, or it could be much smarter than that. Siri suggestions is much smarter than that. On Android, you've got your multiple home screens where apps can go anywhere on the home screen, like on a Mac. But you also, usually you've got an app drawer of some kind that's like alphabetical or recently used, different ways of organizing your apps.
Yeah, so your home screen doesn't have every app on it. It just has the subset that you place there, and then you go into the app drawer to find everything.
Yeah,
your new device.
You've got a dock, and then you've also kind of like the home screen's like an extension of the dock, not everything. And then you've got the junk drawer for all your apps. This is kind of like, oh, I use an Android phone. Where's my app drawer? You know, and it has obviously it's not a problem. We're several years into the iPhone, and people adapt. And in a lot of ways, maybe it's easier for the icon view. But I see a lot of people with page after page after page after page of apps with no organization at all. You can reset your home screen layout to be alphabetical, but you can't say just have it be alphabetical.
And then as soon as you download one new app, you're suddenly out of alphabetical order again.
Yeah, and you gotta go back and reset it. And if you did any customization, it gets lost. So that isn't great. And also, I think your first page home screen with the Apple apps, it's like those aren't alphabetical. It's their default position. The next page of third party apps is alphabetical. So adding just a simple list view at all is kind of a big deal, you know. Like with iPadOS, we got the new, more information dense home screen. You know, it's very minor, but it was also a very big deal because it hasn't changed before. This is kind of like that to me, where any change to the home screen is a pretty big deal, and this is one of those.
Yeah, I kind of imagine this is like either a replacement for or in addition to the search page of the home screen. So, you know, when you swipe to the right and you see search, and you got the widgets below it. Maybe there'd be like a toggle there where you switch that to an apps list and then you see all your apps and you can search your apps from that screen, because you can already search your apps from that screen, but then you could like filter the list that you see. I think it has some nice utility with being able to only show your apps that have like badges. So, you know, as a notification, as a way of trawling through notifications. I don't think they're going to do like the Android approach where this list is a core tenant of the thing. They're still going to focus on the grid for the home screen experience, right? What we know and love, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
But this is like an extra view. I don't even think it would be like what the Apple Watch does, where you literally switch between Honeycomb and List. It would just be like another page as part of the overall Springboard experience.
Mm-hmm. It would be nice. I mean, I've kind of wanted this to be like the lock screen, but to have the homepage zero the option to make that homepage one. So mm-hmm. homepage one, like if you swipe up from the bottom, which is like the equivalent of like a home button click on an iPhone 8 or earlier, you go to that homepage two, I guess homepage one, but if you swipe to the left, you've got the widgets and spotlight. But it would be kind of cool to just have the widgets and spotlight be your default. Like if you unlock your phone, it goes there. If you swipe up, it goes there. You know, have that, just move the notch over, move the button at the bottom over a little bit, the pagination button. But, you know, why not? Because you can't do widgets on the home screen. That's their fix for that. Plus force or 3D touch on icons. I would experiment with that as a default if I could.
And what I always think is kind of weird is that you have, you know, the home screen minus one, which is the spotlight experience with the widgets. But then if you're on any other home screen and you pull down from the top, you just get spotlight.
Yeah, no, it is.
Some Siri suggestions at the top. Yeah. So that could be a view where they put the list of apps and then you can filter by typing or you can just scroll the list mm-hmm. and choose like notification only or alphabetical or whatever you want.
Yeah, my homepage organization is I've got two home screens. One's apps out of a folder that I use frequently or aspirationally. And then the second page is the folders organized alphabetically and then obviously categorically. And then the apps were then organized by a little bit by alphabet, but a lot about how much I use them. And that results in me using Spotlight a lot. So it's very clean and is like a known way to navigate it. But it can be faster to use Spotlight or recent apps in Spotlight. So any changes welcome.
Yeah, I don't think this is going to be like a revolution. It'd be nice. And you might use it occasionally. I don't think they're going to like force everyone down a new model of scrolling a list. It's just not as nice as having a two-dimensional grid to arrange.
Yeah, it depends for me on if they make it the option to be default or not, because mm-hmm. without that choice, it can't be picked up as much. Yeah. You know, just like currently.
It would be nice if they can somehow expose this app list when you're on the iPad and you're trying to do multitasking.
Yeah, you're getting crazy.
Then you could have a nice list of apps that you could just recently scroll through without having to, you know, mess around with the dock or scroll through pages and pages of the home screen.
Yeah.
Which is something we've been wanting for a while, but this is specifically talking about just like the home screen experience, not the multitasking experience.
Yeah, we're limited by the current technology on that, I think. HomeKit in iOS 14, I wrote this story up. It's really neat to me as someone who loves HomeKit. So you've got like three different elements. One's face recognition, one's Apple TV audio, and one's night shift for lights, which is what we're calling it, but not what it's actually called. So I'll begin with that feature. There is this ability in lights that work with HomeKit, but not natively through HomeKit, to adjust the color temperature of your lights based on time of day. And you can't do that internally or in HomeKit directly without creating a bunch of automations that might not actually work the right way, and it's hard to reproduce. So what this is you'll have the mode of, I've got these color temperature changing lights. Right now you can manually adjust those or create automations for those. But you can't just have them out of the box, tap a button. And if it's daylight, then your lights are like a cool temperature. If it's nighttime or as nighttime approaches, they get warmer and warmer until they go from like looking blue to looking, you know, orange, on the extremes. This will be built into that. So this is pretty big deal. And
yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, in like iOS 13, there were new HomeKit features. The biggest was HomeKit Secure Video. And then the later, and then also shortcuts integration with automation. So other than that, though, it's like you've got HomeKit routers, which are slowly coming on board. And even HomeKit Secure Videos, you've got those. It's like, it's kind of a slow process to get beyond the first few. And the experience can be better. But to have this new feature built in is really nice. And LIFX or LIFX or however you want to say it, their light bulbs have this out of the box, but you've got to do it in their app. You can't do it with HomeKit. And I think similarly with Hue, like they make color bulbs and they make color temperature bulbs where it's, you know, you've either got like orange to white or you've got all the colors. And all the color ones can do this stuff too. So it's just a different color picker. And so it's very cool that this is going to be supported. And I think
at the platform level, because that means that's the whole point of HomeKit. You can have all these light bulbs from different manufacturers and control them through one experience, and they can all be synced up with the same schedule for the night shift.
That's right. And you literally don't need to install the third party app if you don't want to. And so unless you want firmware updates. But I mean, and the other thing is like, why are they doing more things with this feature? Are they making their own light bulbs? There's been reports of Apple wanting to do their own hardware for HomeKit. Light bulbs is a very low, you know, like low target where they can, it's a popular category and they can easily do it. So maybe there will be, Apple will have its light bulb moment. We'll see. But that's really cool. Like, I cannot wait to try this. I will.
Yeah, it's cool.
It'll probably be like fragmented in the beta process where like you've got a, like your HomePod will mess it up or something. And cause there's no HomePod beta, but
the only thing I hope is, it doesn't like only work with certain lights of the HomeKit ecosystem, or you have it, so it's not a HomeKit secure video situation where it's like you have to have a special firmware for it to do it, because we know that would take 5 years.
Yeah, I don't think there's any reason to. I mean, there is a difference in if your light bulb is just like a brightness controlled light of one color temperature, or if it has like Hue has three light bulbs. One is like the Hue light bulb. I think they call the one with color temperature shifting Hue Ambient, and then there's Hue Color, which includes all the ambient stuff too. So if you just had the basic bulbs, which are expensive, then it wouldn't work with that. So there's got to be some level of detection, or else it just tries it and fails. But I think most of my bulbs, I'm not sure. I've got a different, some of the rooms I use bulbs that are not color shifting or even like ambient lights shifting. So,
yeah. Well, my problem is like I use the smart switches.
Yeah.
And so they're brightness and on and off, but there's no way that they're going to be able to change the color temperature.
Yeah, I use a good mix of those throughout the house because I've got a certain bulb from Sylvania that works best with Lutron switches with no humming involved. So, but I do have a mix of the Hue Ambience and Hue Color bulbs and like the Hue Go lamp and things like that. So, I just play around with it and see what needs to change. You know, I would imagine that I would like this most for lamps, if not ceiling lighting. But you know, it's fun to play with.
Yeah, a bit of ambience throughout the day.
Yeah, exactly. Other thing is with HomeKit cameras. So there's been the ability to do object recognition for HomeKit secure video, and that means you can detect if there's motion from people, animals, or vehicles. It will try to decide if it's one of those things, and you can say, I only want alerts for people. I don't want alerts for animals or cars because it's my front yard. That kind of thing. With iOS 14, there's this new face classification feature where you can say, we believe you'll be able to say, I only want an alert if it's not someone in my family, or if it is someone in my family at a certain time. So, you can have an alert for detecting specific people in your family. So, and you can imagine detecting people who are not in that family, and then you get alerts for them. So that's at least one way of building onto HomeKit secure video.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's nice to know that there is ongoing development with HomeKit secure video. Yeah. It's not going to be one of the things that Apple did last year and they leave it for 5 years before they revisit it.
Yeah, as we've discussed before, there's also a lot of stuff like time lapse that they could do that they need to do.
Yeah, but like out of the universe of possible improvements, I think they could deliver. This isn't the one that would immediately spring to mind, but
we won't complain.
They're carrying on.
It does show that they're continuing. And then lastly, this HomePod Apple TV speakers. Really, I think it's more just Apple TV speaker targets in general, but HomePods is kind of where it matters. If you have an Apple TV and a HomePod or a pair of HomePods, you can manually select your HomePod as your output device. And it only works with the Apple TV. It won't work with like your cable box or PlayStation or whatever. But if you use Apple TV full time and your TV has terrible speakers like all TVs have, and you don't have a surround system or a soundbar, you can use your $700 HomePod stereo pair as your speakers, which is, you know, reasonable. But when you interact with the HomePod with Siri, originally it would just lose the connection with the Apple TV. I think it's better now, but still flaky.
Yeah.
And this is a feature where it is a specific feature designed to make your speaker output permanent. So I assume this means even if you ask Siri a question on your HomePod and play a podcast or play music, when you go back to the TV, it takes priority and takes over those speakers. You know,
Because I did a post right when HomePod stereo pairing was a thing.
Yeah.
And I did it connected up to the Apple TV because everyone was asking, how well does the HomePods work with the Apple TV? And that post was basically not very well at all, because in the early days, you asked anything to Siri, the HomePods would immediately forget that they were connected over AirPlay 2 to the Apple TV, so you'd have to always reset it. In future OS versions, they have improved it, but it's definitely not perfect. It still forgets it sometimes, just randomly. Other times, if you go into certain apps, that especially ones that use like custom video players, mm-hmm. they then mess with the audio sources, and so the AirPlay 2 connection gets dropped. And like, it's just so much hassle when you just want to tell it, don't do anything else. Don't go to the internal TV speakers. Don't connect to the Apple TV in the other room. Don't stream over here. Just stream to the HomePods that are right in front of the TV. Right. Don't change it. That's what I want. Yes, I want to use my HomePod to just talk to it normally. But when you're playing music or whatever, or video through the television, always go to the same device. And yes, if I go and change it, then obviously respect my opinion. But when I'm not in the menu for the audio sources menu, do not change the audio source. It's like so fundamental, but it makes like a huge difference to practicality of how well is the experience of using an Apple TV with the HomePods or any AirPlay 2 speaker system.
Mm-hmm. Can you do multiple outputs for audio on the Apple TV? Like say you've got a HomePod pair plus another HomePod pair in front of and behind you.
Yes, but it'll only do it for music.
Ah, okay, that's kind of weak. So you'd want to have like a build-it-yourself DIY surround sound experience.
Because it's not going to do surround sound because like AirPlay 2 obviously supports multi-room. That was one of its big features. But you select five different things. They don't know which ones sit where. It just streams a mono audio feed to all five of them or however many you pick.
And yeah.
That's the same experience that you get on the TV. On the TV as
also
well.
Cool would be a cheaper HomePod. I mean, that's no new idea, but a stereo pair, which is ideal for, you know, replacing your TV speakers, is $700 even it's $600 now, right? That's the price drop.
Yeah, because they dropped it by 50.
Yeah, but if you made a smaller HomePod for $200, you know, it's still better than your TV speakers, and it would bring the cost down from $600 to $400 if you wanted to have a stereo pair. And that would be, you know, with this feature too and a new Apple TV, you'd have a whole story to tell there, you know.
And there were rumors of them working on cheaper HomePods.
Yeah.
But they kind of died out a little bit, I feel like.
Well, there's so much going on.
I mean, that is true. But it's not like Quo hasn't mentioned HomePods yet, for instance.
Yeah. Also,
even though he has mentioned a wireless charging mat over your headphones and Apple Tags a million times over.
That's true. Also,
situation has gone dead.
Yeah, it's too bad. Also, new in iOS 14 are some new accessibility features, and then like a mishmash of other things, including like wallpaper and Apple Pay changes. So the accessibility features are largely around audio, and so it includes the ability to have new alerts if on your iPhone, if specific things are detected, and Apple's already got experience detecting some of these things, I know based on what you told me about live photos from their like privacy document. But these are things like notify you if a fire alarm goes off, notify you if a siren is heard, notify you if someone knocks on your door, and like label the alert so that you know what's going on. Notify you if a doorbell goes off, or even if babies are crying, and presumably there'll be like a haptic alert and a visual alert so that you can look at that and you can feel it without having to hear it, and you know what it is. It's more sophisticated than like the noise app, which is like how many decibels is the audio around you. It's what are you hearing, and to receive an alert when something is detected. And I also imagine you could probably like pick, you know, the things that you want to, that you care about. And so that's really cool. This is the thing where it's a control center toggle somewhere. It's definitely, I think, definitely the watch and maybe the Apple Watch, or definitely the phone and maybe the watch. I'm not sure. But it's for toggling on and off the ability to detect sounds. This is one of those things where it's like, it's so smart. It fits in exactly with what they're doing. And it's no surprise, but it's just great to see iOS 14 will have new accessibility features. This is a really good one. There's also an audio accommodations feature. That's capital A. So it's a official feature that runs an audiogram in iOS on device to help the listener tune AirPods or EarPods for specific hearing loss, so that it sounds it's clearer. My friend Will Sigmund, he gave us a couple of comments on this, including on this feature. And something he shared with us is that he uses the male voice of Siri over the female voice because he wears made for iPhone hearing aids and has hearing loss. And so the male voice is clearer to him than the female voice for this reason.
It's the different frequencies.
Exactly. And so the iPhone will be able to perform an audiogram and tune your AirPods and tune your EarPods, which is like the wired version of headphones that comes in the box still, to accommodate that. And you could also see, you could imagine, it's not so far off that you take this accessibility feature, which is basically EQ for AirPods. Maybe they make a non-accessibility feature, which is, I want more bass, I want more treble, tune my AirPods for spoken word, or, you know, or music. That's a spinoff of this, because you get the accessibility feature, and then you could make it a consumer feature in general too. But these are some neat changes coming. And I mean,
yeah, that is cool.
I saw the artwork for the audiogram, and I guess it'd be in the health app. But you know, they have that really cool artwork in the health app for different categories.
Yeah.
It's really cool. It's like it would be a nice wallpaper. So
there. Yeah, and they still have the EQ setting in the music app, which dates back all the way to the iPod days.
Yeah.
But it only applies to the music app and doesn't apply system wide.
Yeah, iPod, like if you had an iPod, it had an equalizer. I think it came in like 2007 or so. It was like the later years. It was the same event where the iPod Hi-Fi came out. It was a software update coming to the iPod as well, which is, I think, a year before the iPhone came out, so like 2006. It's like, we're adding an equalizer to the HomePod, and that's what it was, you know. We've not yet seen,
and obviously,
like,
people have asked for equalizers on AirPods, HomePods. Everyone wants to be able to tune the bass or whatever to their preference.
Yeah, it's, Sonos lets you do it. Like, come on, you know. Let's just do it. Other thing is, the wallpaper section of the settings app on the iPhone and iPad will have some changes. You'll get categories for existing wallpapers like Earth and Moon, flowers, and hopefully that means more wallpapers in those categories if they're going to do it that way. Otherwise, you've got like three things, four things. And the big thing, which is the ability for third-party apps, all of those third-party wallpaper apps that you swipe through and you long press or share sheet to save a wallpaper to your Photos app with permission. Then you go to the Photos app and you set it as your wallpaper. You go to the wallpapers and you pick it from the photo picker.
And then you have to resize it and align it.
Yes.
It doesn't have live photo normally, and it definitely won't have any motion effect or anything. It would just be a static image.
Yeah. Maybe they'll give you a preview of like what some app icons look like in the arrangement or what some lock screen looks like, but not yours, you know, not your number of apps. By having it in the wallpaper section of the settings app and like official integration for those apps to update and be included there, you can imagine A, discoverability, because everyone changes their wallpaper. Like it's so common to see someone's got a personal photo as their lock screen and their wallpaper. So I think it's like a very low bar for like tech savviness to change your wallpaper. And so if you go there and you see, you know, the stock ones, your own photos, or these third-party apps that have wallpaper collections there, they're like, oh, a new way to do this. I didn't ever think of that. And you know, it would be, I imagine, as easy as changing your wallpaper now, whereas before using those apps, it's not complicated, but it's not simple either.
Yeah, it's monotonous, repetitive steps that you could streamline a lot and improve discoverability at the same time. I don't think this will, because one of the big features of Android back in like Android 2.1 was that third-party apps from their app store could do like truly custom backgrounds for their home screen, and not just like a picture. It could do video, and it could do animation, and it could like a stock ticker on your like home screen. There was one that was quite popular, which was like a updating view of a constellation.
Yes.
These like full like live wallpaper, like live wallpapers, right?
Not just press in on the lock screen, but
not just press in and see the same image.
But it animates if you're on the lock screen or on the wallpaper. Yeah,
yeah. Android had like pulled back on that a lot. I think at the time it was for battery reasons, and they're definitely not super popular to this day. So I think they kind of, you know, tried to push them out and say, please don't make these because it destroys the battery.
I mean, they had stock ones too, I believe. Like many of the ones that you talked about.
Yeah. They definitely did. At least at one point, they definitely had built-in ones that were like that. I highly doubt Apple will allow that much flexibility. I know some people want to be like super productive and have like a checklist of their daily tasks on their walls, on their home screen, and then it dynamically update when you like check them off in reminders or a third-party app. I really don't think that will happen. Like the integration you'll see here is kind of like a share sheet extension, where when you go into the wallpapers app, you can see the different providers of different wallpapers from third-party apps. You tap in, you see the wallpapers they offer, you click on one, you set it. I don't think then the third-party app will have the ability to change it out from under you, you know, dynamically throughout the day. I just don't think they're going to let you have that much. You know, it's a battery problem, and also it just, a lot of apps would abuse it. You'd have like Facebook doing, oh, put everything in, you can see a different photo every single time. Like, there are some use cases where it's like, be nice. For instance, if you could have like a dynamic rotation of a photo album, so you could have more than one photo, you know, cycle through. But I think those cases are so small that Apple could just offer them themselves. Like, Apple should offer the option for your wallpaper to change and cycle through your photo library at X interval, not for like this whole third-party ecosystem to come up, which has a lot of potential problems in community management and app store review. Like, I think it'd be much more streamlined than just, you see the wallpapers you have today, well, here's some repositories of more wallpapers you can set instead, and obviously buy them because they're third-party stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so speaking of wallpapers and Apple Watch, a couple of things we haven't mentioned yet. One is that watchOS 7 will have a new feature in the photos face. So right now you can set up a single photo. It can be still or it can be a live photo as your wallpaper. And if it's a live photo, animate, it's pretty cool. As you raise your wrist, you can also select an album of photos. So that's been a feature for a long, long time, where if you've got an album on your iPhone, you don't have to sync it like to your watch per se. It can just be an album on your iPhone, and that syncs. It does sync to the watch, but not like in the photos app in that way. But as you raise your wrist, every time you get a new photo in that album. What you've not been able to do so easily is have a shared album. So if someone has created a shared album and invited you, or if you have a family album with family sharing, or if you made an album and you've invited family to it to see it too, or friends, you can now easily make that your watch face, just like you could any other album. So I imagine it'll work exactly the same way. It's just now it will be an option. And I think it turns out, I was listening to Accidental Tech Podcast last night before the episode was released, and I think Casey Liss was saying that he accidentally did this on his wife's Apple Watch by having the shared album be chosen to sync to the Photos app, and so you could kind of do it. But through the UI, that was like a workaround, and it wasn't like an option when you assign, you know, customize your photo's face. So it's neat that will be a thing now. There's also a new watch face called International, which is a set of flags from different countries. And, you know, keep in mind, this was developed in December, before Corona and all of the mass event cancellations. But I have to imagine that this watch face was made with the idea of the Olympics in mind,
yeah,
this year, because they could sell watch bands. They used to have woven nylon bands that they gave to Olympic athletes with Apple Watches, and they were really cool. They were all like different flags as the band. They don't make the woven nylon bands anymore for some reason. I think they ought to, but it's the sport loop that they've been playing with since then. And I could see the sport loop in the color of the flags, and like maybe even iconography to match, you know, designs of the flag, if not just the colors, but have a band to match. And you could even do like a red, white, and blue band in some pattern that fits all of the flags that are red, white, and blue in some way, or green, blue, and yellow. Like you could do this with a very few bands, but have bands for sale for the Olympics, you know, call them Olympic bands. I don't know, whatever you want, but you can see that being a thing. Olympics aren't canceled, but so many things are.
It's teetering on the edge.
Affected, yeah. It's like, you know, what's going to happen there? So I don't know if that will affect the international face, but this is one. Felipe Esposito reported this for 95Mac. And, you know, it's always cool hearing about new watch faces.
Yeah, and this is very similar to when they made the special Pride face, and they did that, announced it at WWC, and it was available in the software update of the same day.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And they later improved that, too, to have a better animation method. And I think an analog face version too.
Yep, they had an analog version.
Yep. So, hey.
I think, you know, day to day, obviously you're not going to run flags on your watch. I think it's cool though. Like, and they have, I would say they have worse, like, there's that kind of class of watch face on the Apple Watch, which is just like the analog time, the digital time with some kind of animation behind it that's like clearly just like a set of images, right? This I rank higher than some of the others they have. So I think it's perfectly fine for them to have it. I think it's kind of cool. Some people would use it, full stop.
Yeah.
Most people would play around with it for a bit, use it for the Olympics to celebrate, and then move on. I think event-based watch faces are great. And
yeah,
this kind of flexibility and diversity is why everybody wants them to do like a third-party watch face store, which unfortunately we didn't find any evidence of.
No.
But that's exactly why. Like, you know, imagine this, but for any other discipline and category and things, and you could have all of that unlocked by a watch face store. And so at the moment, we're just kind of drip fed based on what Apple wants to invest all its resources in for every single year and which event it chooses. But these kind of things just show that there's so much potential for, you know, true variety and true diversity if they properly open up watch faces to everyone.
Yeah, yeah. Neat. I mean, that's what we have for this week. There are more stories in the hopper that'll come out over time. I'm in charge of what we write and when we write it, but I'm not in charge of when it goes out in the situation. So stay tuned. I'd just drop them all if I could, you know. But
good
we
stuff in the pipe.
Yeah, we definitely have new things, not just leaks coming for next week. So stay tuned. All right. That is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach, and also follow my space news and history website called spaceexplored.com. I am having a blast making that. And Benjamin, you're on Twitter and not on Instagram, and you have a blog. Where are all these things, or are they not?
At BZAMayo and BZAMayo.com.
There we go. Not on Instagram. Well,
not on Instagram.
I don't think that's true. But
I have an account. I just don't use it.
That's the same thing for Space Explorer. I have an account just to like have the username that I wanted. I don't use it.
Yeah, they want someone to impersonate me.
Yeah, and they get a lot of followers because what it is their algorithm. If they follow me, they recommend that too because I follow that. And people are like, "Yeah, I saw that you followed it. And Michael Sieber followed it. So I thought it was good." there's no post there. I need to do something with that. Anyway, that is the Happy Hour podcast. We will be back next week, guarantee it. And we will see you then. Bye, everybody.
Bye, bye.